what we were intending with last week's talk, and also this week's, is by way of preparation for Satchaji's visit in November, November 7th, isn't it? Yeah, November 7th. And I wanted to try and give you a kind of a quick preparatory overview of Vajrayana practice in preparation for the Green Tara initiation. So what I want to do, though, first off, is I want to back up and go to a little bit of a review of what I talked about last week, and then sort of go from there. So last week I talked about the five the five heaps, and how all of human experience, according to the Buddha's teaching, could be boiled down to five different categories, and that nothing was excluded. And those five categories were matter, consciousness, sensation, which means attraction, repulsion, or neutrality. That's feeling, attraction, repulsion, or neutrality, not sentiment. Perception, which is where consciousness and matter come together in the process of perception. And then the technical term is samskara, which means karmic formations, which means our habits, the accumulated habits of our being or of our mind, which is the result of our everything we've done in our lifetime, or lifetimes, if you want to believe it, from that point of view. So those are the five categories, and there's nothing left out. And one can observe that the Buddha did not say that there was a category of something called person or soul or spirit. And that was quite intentional in the way he was teaching. Not that he was specifically trying to say that there is no such thing. And now we get into some contentious sort of dimensions of Buddhist philosophy. But more, what he said was, there is something that appears as a self, or what we might call an ego, or an I, or a me, subjectively me, but it's not a fundamental category of existence. It's an idea. So in that sense, it belongs to the samskara, or karmic formations category. It's an idea. Me is an idea. And that was a very revolutionary notion at the time, because philosophically what was developing in India was this idea that there's something fundamental in a person which is like a soul or a self, which is absolutely permanent, independent of the body, non-destructible. And in that sense, it reflects something that might, from the modern point of view, be called conventional wisdom. I mean, conventionally, most people think that they have an inner nature, which is a soul or something like that, that is permanent. When he dies, he's going to go to heaven, because that's the Judeo-Christian tradition. But the Buddha was saying, based upon his experience, he couldn't find anything like that. Now, there were other religious teachers and teachings that were prevalent at the time that said, no, that's what the truth is. And India was a very pluralistic environment with many different views about reality that were current and developed, and lived more or less harmoniously, by the way. I mean, it's very rare to look at Indian history and see religious conflict in a deep, profound level. I mean, there have been people that have been irritated with each other, and kings would say, I'm not going to see any more money, tax money going to that monastery, it's going to go over here to this temple, and things like that. But there never been religious wars, straight-out religious wars in Indian history. It's basically been a pretty tolerant environment as far as that goes, from the point of view of the world, that is. But anyway, he said he couldn't find anything like that. What he could find was the idea I, the subjective sense I, which was designated onto those five categories of experience. And so to give you a metaphor for this, and this is really important from the point of view of where we're going to in Green Tara practice, this is not a side issue, to give you a metaphor for this that comes up in one of the later scriptures, where there's this great sage called Nagasena who is inquiring of a king, because the royal courts used to have court philosophers. That was our idea of entertainment. They get court philosophers and they debate things, and the kings would sit around and listen. you know, no television or radio. It's a pretty sophisticated form of entertainment. So Nagasena was talking to this king, and he was explaining the Buddhist view, and the king had ridden out to see him in his chariot. And so Nagasena says, well, let's take a look at this thing over here you call a chariot. Let's see where if we can find the chariot. And he says, is the chariot in the wheels? And the king says, no. How about in the reins? The king says, no. Well, if we look at the horses, is that the chariot? The king says, no. How about the platform? Is that it? No. How about the axle? Is that the chariot? No. So he says, okay, king, you said you rode out to see me on a chariot, so where's the chariot? And the king says, well, when you put it all together, that's a chariot. And Nagasena says, well, the same with you as a person. You put all the pieces together and you designate them king, and you've got a king. Just like you put all the pieces together and you designate a chariot, and you've got a chariot. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no chariot. It just means there's this assemblage of parts with the name chariot on it. Similarly, from the Buddhist point of view, it doesn't mean there's no person. It means there's this assemblage of parts with this name on it. Me, person, David, K, President Clinton, whatever you like, you know. And that's a point of some difficulty for people who, yeah, I know, the kiddies want to have a Dharma talk. That's a point of view which is kind of difficult and has created a lot of misunderstanding when people encounter Buddhism, because they think when they first bump into this teaching that it means that Buddhists say that the truth about the person is that they're egoless or they have no self. And that's kind of a simplistic take on it, because it's sort of like, well, it means there's no self apart from designation on the constituents of being a human being. That doesn't mean there's no self. I mean, obviously, I'm sitting here and I feel like I'm David when I'm talking to you. But I feel David in the notion of well, when I look at it closely, of David as an idea designated on this body. And, David felt like David when this body was 10 years old, and there's obviously been a few changes since then, and also in terms of personality and self-consciousness, not just in terms of the body and what that sort of thing means. So the tricky thing in Buddhism is to understand in the middle between too rigid an idea of it really exists and too loose of an idea that it doesn't exist at all. There's this delicate balance between the two, and the Buddha pretty much is always asking people to find that middle place, that middle path is what it's called, that balance point between, yes, I'm a person at the moment when I don't think about it too closely, but if I look at myself really closely, then the personness begins to fall apart in a certain way, and I can see that I am an idea of me that holds together all these constituent parts. Now, that was a radical idea then and it's now. Because then the notion was, well, there must be something that survives after death, and that would be the essential thing. Buddhists wrestled with that, and pretty much they completely agreed that there was no I or self that survived after death. Something did, but it wasn't that. So I'm not going to go into what the something is at the moment. I might loop back to it later. But so that's important, because again, it's easy to think, oh, okay, so the Buddhist view is sort of nihilistic. When I die, it's all over. You know, no, that's not the Buddhist view. Okay, the Buddhist view is when I die, my soul goes on to another life. No, that's not the Buddhist view either. There's something that's between those two that's neither of them. And so that's a real challenge for people to try and get at what that is. The main point, I probably shouldn't do that from the point of view of the recording. The main point, though, from the perspective of Vajrayana practice, is if you can designate I or David onto this body, and that's essentially all that's going on, you can designate I or David onto anything. It's almost a mechanical process. And you can come to see this in meditation. Spontaneously and naturally, you get up in the morning and you feel me. you know, my back hurts, I'm getting old, I got to go brush my teeth, I need a big cup of coffee, do I have to go to work, I, in relationship to all this stuff. But if you sit down and meditate, and you look at that, and you remember what you know from studying philosophy, and you just have a clear look at the thing, you can see that what the process is that I is being attached to these various transitory things. Right now, I is attached to my back hurts. A few minutes later, I is attached to my knee hurts. A few minutes after that, I is attached to, do I really want to go to work? It's snowing outside, you know, all this kind of thing. So, you know, the I gets attached to a different set of thoughts and feelings and so on and so forth. The genius of Vajrayana, and it really is genius if you think about it, is to recognize that the I could be designated on anything. So why designate the I on all the time? Why designate the I on this crumpled up old pile of stuff that's, you know, you're dragging through life? I mean, there's nothing wrong with this bag of bones. I mean, we need it. That's fine. But it's also limited. Suppose you were to designate the I on another part of yourself. Okay. Suppose you were designating the I on your deepest, most profound awareness instead of on your body. Well, you could do that because it's just a process. If you could gain control over the designation process, then you could designate the I on something else than your bag of bones or whatever it is. That's the genius of Vajrayana, is to say, why don't you designate the I on your Buddha nature instead of designating the I on your body and personality? Because the essence of what you are is your Buddha nature. It's just you don't know it most of the time. It's back there as the spacious environment or ground in which you go through your life, kind of looking through you, if you will, or living through you or acting through you. But the I is constantly being stuck onto your body or your personality or your role in life. I mean, so Buddhists really like to say things like, you know, an example came up, President Clinton, and I use this example merely because we were in India at the time Clinton was president, and we heard this example used frequently, so it's kind of stuck in my mind, which is, you know, Bill Clinton was just Bill Clinton until he got elected president, and then he's President Bill Clinton. Now his eye is being designated on this person of power and importance and inflation. And then after 8 years, poof, you know. And Clinton actually created a spoof, a movie spoof, during his last week in office where he was in the White House. He was in a kitchen. I think it was a White House kitchen. He's making a sandwich in a paper bag, and he takes it out, and the limo doesn't even wait for him. It's like he's not president anymore. He's standing there with his lunch bag having to go off to work, and the limo's left him behind because he's just Bill now. You know? So, I mean, someplace he actually got it. He knew what was happening. You know? So, but the point is that, you know, the I was designated because of what we all agreed upon. We said, you can designate your I on the role president. And in fact, we insist on it because somebody needs to do it. We need a figurehead. We need a leader, what have you. So, why not designate your I on something really profound, which is the Buddha within you? But how would you designate your I on the Buddha within you? Because the Buddha within you is formless. Right, it's Buddha nature is the field, it's the space in which you exist. How would you designate I on that? Well, actually, you can do it, but that's pretty sophisticated and pretty difficult to designate form on that which is formless. Okay, so Buddhas have appeared in the world. Okay, what if you designate your I on an image of a Buddha that's appeared in the world? What happens if you do that? What happens if you designate the I on a concept like compassion, or you designate the I on a concept called wisdom? Because these things are within you, you could designate the I on that. So how would you do that? That's what all the Buddha images are. That's what Manjushri is, that's what Green Tara is, that's what Vajrasattva is. These are all aspects of the Buddha or better yet, aspects of the Buddha nature within you, and you take an image of them or a symbol for them to recognize your character as being compassionate, to recognize your deep character as being wise, to recognize your deep character as being compassionately engaged with the world rather than sort of fearfully standing back while it goes by, you know. You designate eye on that and you practice that. And that's called divine pride. Because as I said last week, the two keys to practicing Vajrayana are to have clear visualization of what you want to imagine yourself to be, which is to say what you actually already are, but don't recognize yourself to be. Clear vision or clarity of vision. And the other aspect is divine pride. So see yourself, in this case, as having all the characteristics of Green Tara, as the active, engaged female Buddha who's fearlessly acting in the world for the benefit of beings. Okay? Imagine yourself as being that. See yourself as being that. And assume the divine pride of I am that, because you can designate the I on anything. So instead of designating I on I'm afraid to deal with this, that, or the other thing, you designate the I on I'm fearless. You practice fearlessness. And you practice the image of yourself as being fearless. So you have to have clear appearance. You have to see that as well as you possibly can. But the tricky thing, or many tricky things, one of the tricky things is what we tend to do is we have clear appearance of us as solid and concrete. Well, there's nothing solid and concrete in the formless Buddha nature. So the reason that these images over and over again are said to be luminous, made of light, covered with jewels, luminous robes, and so on and so forth, is for our poor, you know, hardwired minds that want to see stuff, you know, material stuff, to attach to something which is luminous. We can attach to a jewel. We understand a jewel is luminous. There are no light bulbs in the ancient world, right? There were candles and whatnot. But what was the most luminous thing, apart from like the moon, what was the most luminous thing that a person in the ancient world could see? A jewel. Right? So everything in this practice is understood to be jewel-like. Because jewels radiate and express, you know, that luminosity, that light. And light is not solid, and that's the key thing. Because our tendency is to see everything as being solid, autonomous, independent, disconnected from everything else, hard material, rather than seeing a world that's in constant flux, where everything connects to everything, everything emerges in reaction to something else that's going on, everything is dynamic, nothing is really solid, but that's just the way we see everything. So if we're reaching for our Buddha nature, for our deepest nature, we can't possibly reach for our deepest nature if we see it as being hard, solid stuff. It has to be what's truth. What's truth? It's dynamic, interconnected, fluid, empty of the solidity that we imprint onto everything. That's our true nature. So we have to have clear appearance of ourself as luminous, not clear appearance of ourselves as solid, because that which we have the clear appearance of is mental, is formless, is consciousness. And we assume the divine pride that I am that. I mean, we know that in our deepest nature we're all Buddhas, or gods, or whatever we want ourselves to be. We know it. We wouldn't be engaged in spiritual practice if we didn't have an intuition of that, you know. So that's what the practice is about. I mean, in a nutshell, that sort of boils down to.
Speech and mudra.
Well, in the same context, if we're seeing ourselves as a luminous being, essentially we're using the mental power of vision to see ourselves. But we've got six senses. So there's also the mental power of speech, the mental power of gesture or touch, the mental power of thought, and so on and so forth. So we could, just as we designate ourselves on an image of the Buddha, we could designate ourselves on a sound of the Buddha, and even stronger if we were to do both. So what's the sound? Mantra. The sound is mantra. That's the clear appearance, if you will, or the clear sound of Buddha nature that one would designate oneself on. Gesture or mudra, same thing. And thought. Thinking that I am that is a version of designation, of clear appearance, of mental clear appearance. It's like understanding, this is a better way to phrase it. Understanding that nothing is solid, that everything's dynamic and interconnected, is assuming the divine pride of the wisdom of the Buddha. So that's the mental aspect of that, would be a way to talk about it. Okay? I don't want to go overly long. You know, I wanted to kind of hold this relatively short. But the other thing I wanted to do is I want to talk a little bit about Sacho-Jie and who he is, as I understand who he is, and what he'll be doing in this kind of thing. I think I'll turn this off. Though. No?
Here you go. This All is right. fun for those All who right. missed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Sacho-Jie was born in a refugee camp, actually, and it wasn't until he was a teenager that he was recognized as having been a pretty famous lama in a previous life, who actually died in a prison camp in Tibet, and I think it was 1962. And in the Tibetan system, they believe that the people who are very successful in Vajrayana practice can influence, if not outright control, where they're going, the way in which they'll be born in the future. But at least that such people, having taken the Bodhisattva vow to be of benefit to people, will be born again as human beings to fulfill that vow. So the Tibetans, being very practical people, but being very spiritual, think, well, that's fine, let's go find him again. If he said he's going to come back, we'll go find him again. And so they've been having this habit of doing this for quite a long period of time. I mean, it's kind of a rash notion from the Western point of view. And if you want to merely be pragmatic about it, then one could say, well, wouldn't it be a really great idea to find some promising kids who look really intelligent and just, you know, send them to the best schools available and give them, full tuition to go to Harvard and Princeton Graduate School, whatever the case may be, and just, like, give them the best, you know? I mean, just we'll pick a cadre of people and we'll absolutely give them the best, and those will be our college professors instead of the way we do things. I am thinking to myself, it's sort of like, you know, you go to graduate school and you think, well, you know, I'd like to do this, okay, so now, you know, I'm gonna, you know, wait tables and do this, that, and the other thing, and try to make enough money to go to school and do as much of my homework as I can and basically be starving and so on and so forth and, you know, fight my way from one place to another. No, they have this other idea anyway. Which is find smart kids, whether you believe in reincarnation or not. Find smart kids and give them the best possible training and say, okay, now you then train us because we're giving you the best possible training. It's a reciprocity. It's a social reciprocity, if you will. So in Rinpoche's case, they didn't figure out who he was until he was a teenager, which was sort of interesting. But they found him and they said, okay, well, this is who you are. Now you have to go to school. So he started late, but he's really smart and he finished early. And they have a very formalized training program in the big Tibetan monasteries that is really quite an astonishing program in terms of what you study and what you have to learn and have to have powers of mind and to remember things. And they give you exams like, here's, I mean, I had a tough PhD qualifying exam, but I didn't have anything like this. I'll give you an example. There are five classic texts, and then there are many commentaries on them. So one of your examiners will pull a commentary off the shelf, essentially, which can be maybe several hundred pages long. You'll crack it open someplace, and he'll read you three lines, and he'll say, what follows that? And you need to tell him what the half a dozen lines are that follow that. If you can't do that, you flunk. Right. So this is really serious stuff. And the way they study is they engage in debate. You know, they don't just sort of sit around and read books and then, you know, take an exam. But they're out there debating the fine points of philosophy with each other. And, of course, then they also have to meditate and all that kind of stuff. So Rinpoche means somebody who's a reincarnated lama. It means precious one. And the doctoral program, if you will, that you go through is called the Geshe program. So Zachoji went through the Geshe program in unusually fast time because he's really smart and dedicated. And so he has a Geshe, but he's also a Rinpoche, which is how he got through the program. But, by the way, it's not like everything was thrown his way. He had people who supported him. He had donors, because sometimes there's not a lot of money, especially among the refugees. So when Rinpoche comes here, there'll be a young lady traveling with him who is the granddaughter of the donor that got him through the Geshe program. So that's their relationship, and she's become his student, though she travels with him on occasion. She's very interesting herself because, as I understand it, she's half French and half Tibetan because her mother settled in France after the diaspora and married a Frenchman. Or was it her father? Well, whatever the case may be, it doesn't really make any difference. So Rinpoche has a center. His main center is in Phoenix, but he does travel around the world. He's in pretty good demand because he has great English. Very few of the Rinpoches have a lot of good English. He has good English. He has a very casual style, which is a nice thing. That works well for Americans. And we met him in, I don't know, 97 or 98 or something like that, in Bloomington, of all places, when we were out there for Dalai Lama doing that big initiation. And so over the years, we've gotten closer and closer and closer to him. And I actually, along with Kay, had the opportunity to do a Green Taro retreat with him in Flagstaff, where we were living, of all unusual places. And so we've been seeing him over the years, and he came here a couple, three years ago, and he did some talks at the Unitarian Center on the nature of mind and
Quaker Church.
The Quaker Church, I'm sorry. The Unitarian Church in Yakima, Quaker Church here. On the nature of mind, which were pretty well attended. So, you know, we were thinking it'd be really nice if he could come up and he would do an initiation or an empowerment, to use the language that they use, an empowerment of some practice so that you could really meet that kind of tradition. And in the nature of empowerment is... Well, I like the metaphor of yogurt starter. I've used that before. I mean, it's like we can all be milk, but if we want to be yogurt, you got to get some yogurt starter from the previous batch of yogurt introduced into the milk, and then you got to get heated properly, and then you're yogurt. So Rinpoche is the yogurt starter, and your practice will be heat. We'll be heating yourselves up to turn yourselves into yogurt. And you're going to be green tara colored yogurt, as a matter of fact. Okay. So, in a funny way, we'll observe both the formalities and not observe the formalities. And what our thought is, our understanding right now is that Rinpoche, with a few students from Yakima, will come up on Saturday night. And we'll stay in various places, you know, as people are hosting the students. And Rinpoche will stay here, as will Daechin, the granddaughter of the patron we were telling you about. And then Saturday afternoon at a yet-to-be-determined... Sunday. I keep screwing this up. I'm sorry. Sunday afternoon at a yet-to-be-disclosed location, which is probably either the Bowen Camp building or the Union County Arts and Culture Center, one or the other.
Bill Carnegie Library.
Bill Carnegie Library, yeah. He'll do the Green Tower Initiation. And then we'll all gather for dinner someplace, probably Mama Sita's basement if it's open. We still haven't taken the time.
And whoever wants to come.
Yeah, be free to come. And then this group will gather back here, and he'll give us all a private teaching for those of us who've been coming here on Green Tower practice and whatever else is on his mind. Who knows? I don't know. And then he'll leave the next morning and go to wherever he's going, New Zealand or Tibet or someplace. I just can't keep track of it. Anyway. On the whole, out of respect, it would be good to stand up when he comes in the room and not to sit down until he sits down. But beyond that, that's pretty much it. I mean, he's pretty cash as lamas go, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, so since we're doing it for the public, you know, it'd be great if all you guys could kind of lead the way in that when he comes in. The stand up, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then just wait until he sits down. And here too, when we're doing it here.
And there'll be all kinds of stuff that needs to be done, and so we'll send out an email asking for volunteers to do everything from carry chairs to watch the donation bag and bottle to move furniture to this, that, and the other thing.
Watch it, clean coffee. It's not actually that much, you know.
No.
But mostly it's just, we went back and forth about how to do the donation thing, and we think what we're going to do is have it actually be a true donation, where we're not do a suggested thing, and have one bottle that will be for Rinpoche. It's traditional after a Green Tower empowerment or any kind of initiation for whoever took the initiation to make an offering, and it can be whatever you want. And usually one person at the end, and I'm thinking probably Boy, because she requested the initiation, will go up and with a scarf and make that offering, whatever's in that bottle. And the other one will be for people coming in, anybody who wants to help with any of the expenses, you know, but really whatever. Because I don't want anybody to be left out that wants to come, students or anybody, because they can't afford it. So, so that's kind of what we have in mind. And depending on where we are, we're either going to rent chairs, or if we're doing it at UCACC, they've got a lot of chairs, and we may get some extras, but we may need strong students, April, to carry them up from the basement on Saturday. And Charlie said if we do it there, he's got a big rug so that we can actually tell people if they want to bring cushions and sit in the very front. They can do that on the floor too. And we're just going to have coffee and tea and water. I think it's all really, you know, because it's only 2 or 3 hours, a couple hours. So, and so we'll probably need somebody to kind of watch that area, just make sure there's water in there and stuff. And, yeah, and somebody to greet people. You know. That's about it. There's not a whole lot. But
there is one piece of advice that I have for everybody who goes through this empowerment. And you can do it just as a blessing. You know, if you don't want to practice Green Tower, that's fine. You can just be there. And if you want to practice it, then that's fine. You know, because what the empowerment is about is not just, okay, here, now you can become yogurt, but this is how you cook yourself, which is what the practice is. Okay. There's a lot of energy in empowerment. The Buddhist, the Vajrayana view is that mind has two aspects. It has the aspect of cognition or knowing, and it has an energetic aspect. And that they're two sides of one coin. And what the yogurt really is, the yogurt starter really is you meet that energy of mind, which is the Green Tower energy of mind, which is within Rinpoche, and he's received it from somebody, and there's a whole lineage that goes back. And if there isn't that unbroken lineage on back to the time of the Buddha, then you're not permitted actually to do that kind of empowerment. So he has that. And when you meet that energy, the first thing you're probably going to want to do is feel good, jump up and down, and throw it away. Get excited and just go like that. Okay, so one of my teachers said, don't. It's hard not to. You'll want to. If you meet it. You know, if you don't experience it, you don't experience it. But it probably will be there. And so you just want to stay cool. And you want to conserve it and you want to notice it, and you want to experience it, and you want to treat it like something very precious, and cultivate it. Yogurt starter can go bad, right? Yogurt starter can go bad, so you have to take care of it, and that's really what I'm talking about. So it'll be complicated to do that because we'll be going out to dinner afterwards and everyone will be kind of like engaged with that. And then we'll come here and so there'll be a lot of like rustling around. So just be a little mindful about what's going on and how you talk to people and what you say and how excited you get about different things. And don't get in the spouse with your, don't get in a fight with your spouse and this kind of thing.
Because that's the other way you can go. It's just so much energy if you don't know quite how to deal with it.
If the sidewalks are icy, don't slip. You might get a little spacey or something like that. And then, you know, we'll reconvene here and get another bit of it. My sense is that there's something strong that's about to happen because ever since we kind of decided that we were going to ask Rinpoche and we did and he agreed to come, every time I'm sitting here preparing for the Sunday evening classes, my head is exploding. So, something's afoot. So, there you have it.
So, two quick questions. Do you anticipate a large crowd at the public?
I don't. She does.
We don't know. I mean, I do based on last time. You know, we did it at the Quaker Church, and it was standing room. It was packed. Standing room only. And I also think about, remember, I don't know if some of you went to that film on physics. I think there's a whole bunch of people that are in our area that are probably in our age group that wants something. Mm-hmm. And they might not know exactly what this is, but we're going to put it out as a blessing too, empowerment or blessing, but they want to come participate. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking if that group kind of gets tuned into this, that it could actually be quite a few people. So we're going to set up for probably about 100 for chairs, but I don't know.
Gross. Last time we talked about it, she said 70.
No, that's how many chairs we have.
Oh.
No, I think we need a few more. But also to have room for, you know, like Charlie was saying, well, I like to sit cross-legged. We almost gave up that idea. So we're going to put on there if people want to bring cushions, and that'll extend the space anyway. And they put a new floor in that place. And so now there's actually a really large, nice, empty space to do this in if we do it there. He's going to contact his board members. That's our first choice. And if they say yes, the Bowen Camp's already agreed to it if we want to do it there. Mm-hmm. So if that doesn't happen, then we'll go in that direction instead. It's a little more expensive. But on the other hand, we'll have to rent chairs there, all the chairs, but it's all on a flat surface, so then we wouldn't be carrying, you know, chairs upstairs and stuff like that, too. So.
Such a quick question is, how late do you anticipate, I mean, then we come back here and then?
Probably the usual time.
Yeah.
Oh,
just,
okay.
Yeah, just a couple hours, probably. Okay. Yeah, 6:30.
I mean, if we do the 6:30 to, you know, 6:30 to 8:30, that's, I mean, you know, he's a human being.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going out for fairly early then.
Probably right after the empowerment. And I'm guessing it'll end at 4. It might end a little earlier than that.
Yeah.
And does anybody know if Montecitos is open on Sunday?
No. And what would they have to eat, really? I mean, I don't know. I've never been impressed with their food.
We will find some place.
They're usually not open Sundays.
They're not open Sundays. Then we'll have to find somewhere else.
They were closed.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's that. Well, maybe a Chinese restaurant. Like the one next to Foley's. That has bento boxes, and he likes bento boxes. So we'll find something. But what we're thinking of...
Buddhists, too, Frankie. Yeah, they used to have Buddhists.
Yeah. We're thinking maybe starting the empowerment around 1 in the afternoon, and that would last a few hours, and then get a meal and then come back here, which is all the more reason why we'd need some strong back students on Sunday also, because we don't want to have to be involved in doing that, putting things together. I don't know how we would arrange this. We'll talk with you. All by himself?
I'll get somebody else.
Okay.
Yeah, right. It's just, everybody, I don't know, we've got, he's got a sore back, I've got a sore knee, he's got a sore knee. I mean, how many y'all, you know, it's like, and, you know, carrying chairs up.
No, I could do it all myself, but I'd rather be here. On that note, I better shut off this recording.